Today is Monday, the 11th of May, 2015. A beautiful spring Monday morning here in Jerusalem, and ready to roll. Now, I have a number of comments to make in relation to the last few last week's lecture in particular. I received a lot of compliments from around the world, but I have to state my role in the lecture, without Rabbatan Steinsaltzer, would have been a very normative lecture. Rabbatan Steinsaltzer's chapter on the Rav and the Rebbe, on the Rebbe and his wife, to me is the greatest piece that Rabbatan Steinsaltzer wrote. It's so perceptive and so insightful. So give him the credit, not me. Number one. Number two, the correction we made is a very important correction. It may be because Rabbatan Steinsaltzer's English is not native. I believe his native language is French, if I'm not mistaken. A death sentence in English has a negative connotation. A life sentence has a more positive connotation. So I stand on my correction. Now, I have to say I got two emails that made me laugh. One, I get a great shayurim on the Rebbe, et cetera, and then I said that the Rebbe never left 770, so he says this sounds bizarre. He left, he went to the Ohel, he went to Fabrengens and other halls in the 1950s. I just wanted to explain that the Rebbe never left 770 is a figurative expression. No one, even Rakefet may be dumb, but he's not that dumb to think the Rebbe didn't go home at night to sleep. Of course he walked out of 770. But what the expression means is very simple. It's like the Rav. The Rav emigrated to the United States. All of you know he wanted to go to Chicago. Chicago brought him to America. Chicago, I've lectured on this extensively. I have the documents. Chicago then pleads poverty. And they write to Rav Moshe, they send him a telegram. We brought your son to America, but now find him a rabbinate. And at that time, the Boston rabbinate opened up. Knowing the Rav as well as I do, I hope, I can tell you the Rav never left Boston. You follow me already? Doesn't mean he didn't. Of course he left Boston. But his whole personality became a Boston personality, New England. He became a Brahmin. Look into Webster's International. You'll see one of the definitions of Brahmin. He thought New England was tops, Boston was best, Harvard, Radcliffe. Wow, what Boston had to offer the New England area. And Allah had come of a comma when you say the Rebbe never left 770. It's an amazing thing. They can document in the 50s a few times he went upstate to the Chabad camps. He visited the camps. Then in those years he was Masada Kedushin in wedding halls. So he went to some wedding halls in Brooklyn. He went to the Ohel, but he mamish never left 770. One time he went back to Europe, knew you tell me when, to bring his mother back. After World War II, when his mother finally reaches France from Russia, so the Rebbe goes and spends some precious time with her in France. But I just want to say, I am correct when I said the Rebbe never left 770. Now, this is very interesting. I quoted to you that the Rebbe's relationship with the Rebbetzin, and ultimately, I don't know if I said this last week, but I said it when my mother died, and I was maspid my mother, and I made a seam here in the Kollel. So I said, with the death of my mother, it really hurts more than you can imagine, because every morning I would come in to visit her. She lived in Givat Mordechai, Rechov Shachal, and each and every time she would say, Ani, good morning, how are you? And I said, now I have no one left who calls me Ani. Malka won't call me Ani in principle. If I'm doing well, it's Aharon. If I'm doing bad, it's Anu. But Aharon is my name, Bnei Akiva. And when your mother calls you Ani, it ties you to your youth, to your roots. And when the Rebbetzin died, the Rebbe said that it's very sad for him because there's no one in the world now who's going to call him Mendela. And it's a deep, deep thought. Now, what I cited to you was that the Rebbe, Dr. Ira Weiss, Bon Appetit, reports the Rebbe is saying to him that the daily tea he had with his wife was as important to him as tefillin. And I get a correction. The key word was meticulous, not important. And he quotes Ami magazine. The Rebbe made sure to drink tea with its Rebbetzin every day, according to his cardiologist, Dr. Ira Weiss. The Rebbe was as meticulous as adhering to their daily tea party as he was of putting on his tefillin. So I want you to know I went back to my source, the Steinsaltz book, and Baruch Hashem, I quoted him correctly. He has the word, quoting Dr. Ira Weiss, important, not meticulous. So now the question is, who is telling the truth? Ami magazine or Reb Adin Steinsaltz? Rav Kefet is only a very innocent bystander. I'm a fallout. So check it out. I'm willing to bet that Rabbi Steinsaltz is probably more accurate than Ami, because Ami probably figured, you know, Ami is worried about the Frumkeit. A person reading this, ay vey, the Lubavitcher Rebbe considers having tea with his wife as important as putting on tefillin. It's terrible. Meticulous sounds a lot better. But I will, if anyone can check out what Ira Weiss originally said, we'll know whether Ami is right or whether Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz is right. Now, another email that I got, which was beautiful. This is from my Talmud, Rabbi Yonatan Berger, Yonason, as he calls himself. I hope all is well. I think that the Chabad Rebbe's analogy to the tefillin and the time we spent with the Rebbetzin is alluded to in the Nusach we say, namely the Psukim, when putting on the Ksharim around the figures, Verastichli Liolam, etc. And it's a beautiful, beautiful comment. And I thank Yonatan. Okay, now just a few words to continue the biographical trail of the Rebbe. And then we'll go in very deep. I don't know if we can finish it all today. We're going to come to a topic that is loaded with tension, the Rebbe and his relationship with Moriah Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik. Following the marriage, the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin move to Berlin. And he spends approximately 5 semesters from 28 to 1930 in Berlin. People have done research, and the Germans, lo aleinu, as we know, were very meticulous in keeping records. And I say lo aleinu because just imagine today, Ruby Rivlin, the president of the State of Israel, is going to Germany. He was received yesterday with an honor guard in Germany. And I don't know, I have very, very mixed emotions about it. As I've said more than once, had I been around and had a say when we wanted to establish relations with Germany, I would have been absolutely opposed to relations, to reparations. Maybe 1,000 years from now we can talk about it. And the Rebbe is very, very opposed. We have the Rebbe on tape yelling and shouting and screaming and sounding more negative towards it than Menachem Begin. And as you know, Begin stood on the street corners here in Jerusalem and yelled and shouted against relations with Germany. All right, others say that, Rav Kefet, you're an idiot, you don't know what you're talking about. They paid us money. Without that money, there'd be no State of Israel, there'd be no Israeli museum, there'd be no economy, and there's truth to that too. So I don't say kiblu et dati, but I know what I feel. Anyway, be it as it may, he went to Berlin, and Menachem Friedman, is a professor at Bar-Ilan. He's a great expert on the Haredi world. He took over Charles, if you remember the name Charles Liebman, who became famous off a piece he did in the early 60s on a guy named Rothkopf and his rabbinate, his ill attempt to be a rabbi in Lower Marian Synagogue, 61-62. Although I have to say, LeKavod Rothkopf, he was re-elected by a vote, I think, of going to Washington, go to Charlie's article. I think the vote was 9-7 in favor of re-electing him. And Charlie's genius is he analyzes who voted for the rabbi and who voted against the rabbi and why. It's very insightful. Menachem Friedman took Charlie's place as the one who knows the Haredi world well, and particularly in Israel. And he did research in Berlin. And they found that, quote, the Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, audited courses at the Berlin University without receiving academic credit. And there's no question that he spent 5 terms in the university auditing various classes. He did not work for a degree. It wasn't like the Rav, who worked for a degree, who worked for a doctorate, who achieved the doctorate, who wrote a thesis. The Rebbe evidently had the luxury of doing as he wished. I have one grandson who has 2 masters and 2 bachelors and 2 masters. And now we got after, you know, it's about time you supported your wife and children. His wife has a master's in Jewish philosophy, but she makes a living. She's a skilled, very, very, very bright family. And she's a lawyer. So now we got after my grandson. We said it's time that you know, he does have a job, but you got to do something serious with life. You just can't go on being an eternal student. And he has various fields of interest, learning and history and Middle East studies. It's a pleasure to talk with him. You know, he really understands. So the Rebbe had support. His father-in-law supported him. He now was free to study. He evidently took in a great deal of the Western world, and with his Geinische Cup, with his fabulous mind, whatever he learned, he later builds upon, he explores, he goes deeper, he keeps up to date in certain fields with the literature, with the developments, but a formal degree he never got in Berlin. In Berlin, he later goes to Paris, and there he becomes a more formal student. Now, while in Berlin, there's no question he remains in close touch with his wife's parents. He occasionally is called back to Warsaw, called back to Riga, I should say. The Rebbe was still in Riga at the time, to help, to speak, to edit writings. In Berlin, he has a tremendous correspondence with the Rocket Shava Gong and his Chidushei Torah overflow. Later, after his death, they find the Rebbe's handwritten notebooks. It's published by Chabad. And on this level, there's a tremendous similarity, once again, to the Rav in Berlin. The Rav in Berlin, here he is getting a PhD. Here he is mastering the Western world. Here he is mastering Greek, Latin, many languages, German, English, and at the same time, constantly learning, writing Chidushei Torah, corresponding with his father. His father supporting him from America. He has to show he's worth the support. He's corresponding with his father. Many of the letters that are later published by Reb Chaim, by his son, his only son, my classmate, Dr. Grach, as you call him, Reb Chaim, as I call him, later, these letters wind up in the grid, the Igrot HaGrid. And now another Sefer came out from Reb Chaim. So you see, there is a tremendous similarity there, those years in Berlin. On one hand, their basic gestalt remains the same with ever-increasing intensity. On the other hand, they are blossoming. They're opening up to this big world beyond them. Now, here we come to the question that so much has been written about, so many have spoken about it. What was the Rav's relationship with the Rebbe? And I want to tell you what others have to say, and then I'll give you my opinion. I don't want to use the word erudite opinion, but my educated understanding. And I have one advantage that most people do not have, simply that I was privileged to discuss this with the Rav. And we'll talk about that. But first I want to begin with the negative opinion. And I'm going to give you sources, and one of them is going to be a source very close to home, but very, 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 let me begin with a source that's a little bit distant. Let's come back to our friend Rabbi Shaul Shimon Deutsch, who is a very fascinating individual. You all know in Borough Park, he's now built a museum. Some Gentile donated. It's an amazing story. La Briut. I see you're eating healthy food. Kol HaKavod. Some Gentile donated artifacts that are worth millions and millions of dollars to this museum, which is fascinating. A Gentile donating, he didn't want it to get lost in a big museum and in a little museum, and he's a very knowledgeable, capable individual. I've met Rabbi Deutsch, the Lyoshna Rebbe, as he calls himself. So he had two volumes, Larger Than Life. I don't believe he's gone beyond these two volumes. It's the first part of the Rebbe's life. And he's not the most popular figure with Chabatnikim. The reason is that Deutsch represents a bit of a rebellion, and let me say it from his point of view. He was very upset with the Messianic movement that began in the later years of the Rebbe's life and what happened after the Rebbe died. And here I want to tell you, and I want to repeat this again, and I want it to be recorded for history, because again, I'm probably one of the few people who know this as time marches on. The problem with Chabad, and this problem haunts us until today, is that if anyone becomes through listening to my lectures, and Baruch Hashem, I have a lot of credit in this field, people who came back to Yiddishkeit, remained Jews, became Jews, can tell you endless stories, and that would end the whole class today, just telling stories, true stories, from this room, from this microphone, from YUTorah.org. But that's not important. What's important is if a person becomes frum, it's not that his frumkeit hangs on Aaron Rakefet. He will say, I became frum, the sheyurim of Harav Rakefet were a catalyst. You follow me, Shashi? A catalyst. Underline the word catalyst. With the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he was such a total enveloping personality, and the context of Hasidus, it's not the Litvisha world. This is not like the person spoke the other night when we had the memorial for Rabbi Hurwitz. I wrote a beautiful thank you note to Rabbi Bella. I wrote back to me, he's my Talmud. But you know, you never heard a Talmud gets up there and says, and I was knew nothing, I'm a Baal Tshuva, I'm coming in from England, and he says, I went to Ar Sameach, and then I come to BMT, and they tell me there's a Rabbi Rakefet, you will love him. And I meet Rabbi Rakefet the first time. He's describing this in the auditorium. No beard, short sleeves. This is a rabbi. He said, I didn't know what was going on. And then a day later, I walk into the Beis Medrash. They tell me, oh, that's Rabbi Lichtenstein sitting there. He's going to give Shin the Kolel in an hour. And he says, he's sitting there like Rakefet, short sleeves, no beard. This is a rabbi. So you see, when you come into Chabad, you come into an entire configuration. And when you're part of that configuration, it's as if all your Yiddishkeit hinges on one person, on the Rebbe. Now, this can be positive, but it can be negative. Negative in the sense that how do you move on without the Rebbe? And I once spoke with one of the great names that you appreciate in this world, Tova Lichtenstein. Spoke with her at depth. Whatever I have to say about the Rebbe, I spoke with the family, the Kronitz, my own conversation with the Rebbe. So she said something very insightful that could very well be that if you notice, the Messianic movement intensified as the Rebbe grew older, because when someone grows older, when I was 50, 60, no one ever said to me, Rebbe, you should have long years and be able to teach until 120. Today, when I'm, a lot older, I told you my last birthday was 770. It was a Chabad. Remember when I said in class, I turned 77 and I mentioned Zagonish, 770. So you get older, everyone says to me, Rebbe, you should have long years. And the truth is they're right. you're older, you look around, who's left from my generation? The last words that Rabbanu Lichtenstein said to me were in this room. I gave a shiur, it was our final weekend, and it was a few years ago. And we all came, and Rabbanu came to my shiur. And it was a powerful shiur, dealt on how is Matir the Agunner and what it means to be a Rav, and I quoted there. And he said to me, Lo nas lechol lo ko ata eino. That's the last words, actually. We spoke afterwards, but nothing that serious. And I had trouble understanding him, his speech. I had trouble understanding him. So, you see, the more you have the Messianic movement, the more you keep the Rebbe alive. If the Rebbe is Mashiach, then he can't die. And this becomes a terrible problem. Because you have Balei Tshuva, you have them by the tens, by the hundreds, by the thousands, where their whole Yiddishkeit hinges and rests on one individual. Now, you should know that and I've told you this, and I repeat it again for the sake of history, the New York police force was very worried that if the Rebbe would die, there would be mass suicide. This is one of the reasons the Rebbe was kept alive artificially. I'm probably one of three or four people in the world, who saw the Rebbe on his deathbed, and you know how, very simple. If you read Washington, you find out I became very close to a very prominent doctor, Dr. Bernard Kabakow, should live and be well. He's not a youngster today. His wife died, and I had a terrible. I gave the hesped at the Shloshim. I gave a whole talk on his wife. I was there. I was the only speaker, basically, family. And then I gave and people were coming in to hear me, and two women were killed on a motorcycle coming in from the Yishuv, what's it called, where Rabbi Cohn, Rabbi Dr. Kabakow's son-in-law is rabbi, in the Gush, the Yishuv that always gets into trouble with extremism. Rabbi Daniel Cohn, what's it called? What, I can't hear? Bad Ayin, thank you. Bad Ayin, exactly. That's the Yishuv, exactly. Bad Ayin. Somehow I can think of El Azai, I can think of the Vei Daniel, but Bad Ayin, which is right next to them, always escapes my mind, for I think you understand why. And it was a terrible tragedy. So Dr. Kabakow was the most famous oncologist in America, in New York. If they wrote about him in every magazine. I was in his house for Shabbos. The phone didn't stop ringing from all over the world. He had to give guidance, what to do, how much of this, that. Terrific doctor. So he took me in Beth Israel Hospital, where the top floor was closed off and police stood guard. That's where the Rebbe was, and only two Gabbayim were allowed in. They sat on the side. And Bernie Kabakow, Dr. Kabakow, took me up and showed me what was going on. We spoke with Label. Label, of course, knows me. And the Rebbe was kept alive. Why was the Rebbe kept alive? During this period, the police called in all the psychologists and psychiatrists who were from, and they knew of, and Chaver Itlay, including many Talmidim of mine, to discuss how to handle what would happen after the Rebbe died. And they were mamish worried about mass suicide. Now, when the Rebbe did die, you all know what happened. Instead of mass suicide, it took on a different psychological tinge. You know, those of you who have studied psychology, had the Rebbe died suddenly, there might have been suicide. But here, it seeped in. The Rebbe's not well, whether you like it or not, he may very well die. So, if you recall, the Saturday night after the Rebbe's death was announced, some of the Hasidim were drinking L'chaim. The Rebbe's now in a higher world, a better world all over the world, and he is Messiah, and he's going to come back, etc., etc. And this movement began. Now, the movement, and we'll talk about it in depth next year, Be'ezrat HaNotein LeYov Koach, but the movement is not the majority of Chabad, but it is a vociferous minority. It's what you call in halachic language a miut hanikar. And Rabbi Deutsch, who was from the old time Chabadnikim, he was very, I would say, dismayed by this movement. And in Larger Than Life, his goal is to portray the Rebbe as the Rebbe, but as a mortal. That these stories about the Rebbe, you know, he was a mortal, he was a human being like all of us, like anyone else. And real through and through blue Chabadnikim can understand Rabbi Deutsch. Many who are Gevorener, Nish Gevorener, came on, but were not born into it, have a lot of trouble with Rabbi Deutsch. So his relationship with Chabad today is, to use a common word, is a hate-love relationship. This is what I discern from the vibrance, from the currents around me. And I can tell you, I have Chabadnikim Talmidim who are very solid and very down to earth, and they're not messianists, but I know if they catch a mistake in Deutsch's two books, they rejoice. They show me the mistake, they show me the sources, and they rejoice. They're happy. They captured him. They caught him. They him gechapt. Now, with that being said, so I want to take the chapter on the Rebbe's friends and acquaintances in Berlin. It appears in volume 2, beginning on page 113. And all three proteges who met in Berlin in 1929, Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Isaac Kuttner, Menachem Schneerson, sustained a self-image so powerful and a certitude so unqualified that there could be no room for even delicate criticism among them, as they each developed mutually exclusive kingdoms, so to speak. Matan, secular, Talmudic, philosophic synthesis for Rabbi Soloveitchik. A worldwide Hasidic movement for the Lubavitcher Rebbe and an elite Talmudic, pietistic training center for Rabbi Hüttner. And this was written, by the way, it's not Deutsch, he's quoting Hillel Goldberg. Now Hillel Goldberg, those of you who don't know him, he's a person worth knowing. The problem is, he should have stayed in Israel. Again, I apologize, Dave, but Aaron Rakefet is a Zionist. It hurts me. I love him. Yeah. But it was a family business, the Intermountain Jewish News. It's the newspaper for the greater Denver community. His family owned the paper. When his father died, his mother needed him to come back and help run the family business. And he's in Denver. He's learning. He's publishing Sfarim. He runs the Intermountain. He is a Baal Tshuva. The family was traditional. The family was Jewish. But the family was not Orthodox in the sense that we know Torah, where we surrender to Halacha. His story, he's a late bloomer. I'll tell you a story about how we interact in this very building. Something amazing happened. He was a late bloomer. And in Boston, the Boston Rebbe turned him on. He became a totally from Jew. After he finished college, he comes to yeshiva, studies for smicha. 4 or 5 years later, then most people start their smicha training, and becomes tremendous mind. Talmud Chacham does a PhD on Musa, and we interacted here. This is before he left Israel when he was teaching, and we had a memorial here. 1982, I believe it was, the 100th Yard site of Reb Yisrael Salanta. So, of course, one of the speakers is going to be Aaron Rakefet, doctorate in Jewish history, Reb Yisrael Salanta, of course, it's my ballpark. And one of the other speakers is Hillel Goldberg, who did a doctorate in Jewish history on Reb Yisrael Salanta. And there we are in front of a few hundred people, and I get up and start talking about probably the second greatest influence in my life next to the Rav was Mori Rebbe from Musser, Rav Lessen, Rav Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessen, the mashgiach in the yeshiva, and Hillel Goldberg embraces me and declares to everyone the greatest influence in my life when I came to YU, second only to the Rav, was Rav Yaakov Moshe HaKohen Lesson. So that both of us owe a great deal to the Mashgiach. And Hillel Goldberg, a golden pen, very insightful. He laid up, collects his articles and puts them together in a fabulous volume. I believe it's called From Slabodka to Berlin. And his article on Reb Yitzchak Kutner, which appeared in Tradition and is incorporated into this volume, is probably the most insightful essay you will ever find on Reb Yitzchak Kutner. So you see, these three people knew each other. What they had in common was total dedication to Yiddishkeit. What they had in common was unbelievable minds. But there they split. Each one went his own way. Now, with the Rav, there is no question that the Rav and the Rebbe interacted in Berlin. There is no question in my mind that there was mutual respect and understanding between them. And I can prove it very easily, and I'll give you sources afterwards. When the sixth Rebbe traveled to America, came back from America, he dropped off from Berlin to visit his son-in-law. One of the great people he was introduced to in Berlin was Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. And the sixth Rebbe writes about it. This is not something we're guessing. This is the sixth Rebbe talks about the fact that he was introduced to the Rav in Berlin by his son-in-law, and how impressed he was with the Rav while going for his doctorate, learning day and night and being Machadesh Torah. Now, I can tell you in parentheses, and this is only a theory, and Jason, whenever you state a theory, do it humbly. In Bernard Revel Graduate School, I had one professor, Professor Joshua Finkel. Joshua Finkel didn't have the guile of the other professors. I spoke about this a year ago in Bernard Revel. It's going to go on. They videoed all this, my speaking, my pointing out, my walking with Balabatim, who are dropping $1 million a piece, and they want to hear about Bernard Revel, and it has not gone on yet. And Rob Shaw has tried to release it without success. They say they're going to have a website. You'll be able to see it. So when I went to Bernard Revel Graduate School, we had professors, their egos were almost as big as their scholarship. You understand? You had to be very careful not to walk on the edge, not to crack them. And Bernard Revel, and this was part of the game. This was the European tradition. I understand that Hebrew Yudas tradition still exists. All right. I hope it doesn't exist in Griscolel. So the Rav and the Rebbe, Joshua Finkel said, he was humble. When you have a theory, don't overstate the case. You can't be certain. But I'll throw in my little theory here, and you can play with it for the next 120 years. It is reported that the sixth Rebbe was very upset with his son-in-law, his brilliant, beautiful, genius son-in-law, a gon, a tzaddik, a chassid, Torah kol kula, nigla v'nista. He's going to university, and Deutsch reports he has sources. You got to read Deutsch's books. They're very fascinating. Whether the scholarship is 100% correct, all right, you can argue at times. But they're very, very fascinating. He reports there were eyewitnesses that they heard the Rebbe, the seventh and the sixth Rebbe were together in the sixth Rebbe's office, and the sixth Rebbe was yelling at him, shouting at him. You know, I learned in Lakewood to tell them you're going to university, you're going to college, a shake, it's a nice for a trumpet, what are you doing? could very well be that the seventh Rebbe, Avram, introduced his father-in-law to the Rav to see you can go to college and you can be Reb Chaim's Einikel grandson and you can remain Reb Chaim's Einikel. It's an interesting thought. Could be. We're never going to be able to solve it 100%, but it makes sense. Okay. The sixth Rebbe was very respectful of the Rav. The sixth Rebbe was very impressed by the Rav. Now, with the Rav and the sixth Rebbe, this becomes critically important. And this is what Deutsch writes about, what I've written about, and this is absolutely fact, 100%. You can bring the simplest proof to this close relationship between the sixth Rebbe and the Rav, because when Reb Moshe Soloveitchik died, he died very suddenly. Rabbi Revel died December 2nd, 1940. Rabbi Revel was in bad health for years. Rabbi Revel, who today is so forgotten and Artscroll totally eliminates him from their history volumes, which is just criminal, criminal. You can say, we don't agree with YU today. We don't like people like Rakefid, Zionists, and open-minded, Chveis. We don't like people like that. Where's the Kippah Shrugar, Amalek? You can say whatever you want. Say whatever you want. Believe me, it doesn't affect me. Baruch Hashem. I'm only looking up and at my students. But YU 100 years ago was the only game in town. They turned to soil. Acknowledge Revel. Say later we're upset. It went on the wrong path. It became a university. We don't agree with this, etc. We don't agree with the Center for the Jewish Future. We don't agree with this, that, the other. But 1920, you have a movie of Reb Shimon Shkup giving shir in what becomes YU, and you don't release the movie? This is criminal. Criminal. So we can prove very simply the sixth Rebbe and the Rav, it was a love affair. How do we know it? In the 1930s, the Rav had tremendous aggravation in Boston. I spoke a little bit about this yesterday in class on with Reb Chaim with Sam Dershowitz. We got to hear yesterday's shiur. It was very, very fascinating. I pulled one, you know, I showed how heating a mikveh affects building an Erev. And Rabbi Bednar said, what are you talking about? I said, that's what the class is about. I don't reveal the secrets before the class, and I don't repeat them after the class. Baruch Hashem, it's online now. So the Rav had a lot of aggravation. You didn't have Balabatim in Boston in the 30s like the Solomon family. People viewed the Rav, you know, an upshot, a wise guy, a wise Alec. I write about it with the Birchat Kohanim on Shabbos, Yonta falling on Shabbos, etc. What the hell is he coming in here upsetting the apple cart? He had a lot of Akmas Nefesh. And then another rabbi came into Boston and Big Machloket broke out over Kashrut. And before you know it, the Rav is in the headlines, he's kashrut, he's a phony, he's not reliable. I can't even repeat all the words, it hurts me, it's my Rebbe. And investigation. Now, when his father died, he's the logical person to succeed his father. Right or wrong? Who else? He's there. He's in America. Reb Chaim's an Einikel. Reb Chaim, his smicha from the Kovner Rav, from Aaron Dobe, Kohana Shapiro, read that the Rav has the gestalt, has the spirit, the ability of his grandfather Reb Chaim. Who else should succeed? But students are students, and you all know there's many students raised the issue. Ah, come on. He's affiliated with Agudat HaRabbanim, he's affiliated with the Heksher Kings, he's affiliated with the phoniness, with the old rabbinate, with everything we hate. Students are always going to build a new world, a more beautiful world. And it has to be that way. I don't want to be cynical. It has to be that way. Halavai. Halavai, you, my dear students, should build a more beautiful world than the world I grew up in, and the world I lived in, and the world that I built. Halavai, you should take it further. But ultimately in life, students grow up and they start to see things in a little bit deeper, with more hue and more coloration and more configuration. Okay, so it really was a battle. Who will succeed Reb Moshe? Shulamit Meiselman, the Rav's sister, in her memoir, attributes her father's sudden death to the aggravation that they don't want to appoint the Rav as the successor. Read the memoir, Shulamit Meiselman, the Soloveitchik Heritage, I believe it's called. And she's black and white about it. And the Board of Trustees is split. Split? The sixth Rebbe contacts the very wealthy businessman who was a Lubavitcher chassid from the old home, who loved the sixth Rebbe, supported him, helped him, gave heavy money, helped the Jews behind the Iron Curtain, Abraham Mirza, M-A-Z-U-R, I believe the name is. And he played Abraham Mirza, M-A-Z-E-R. And this is on page 116. This is the Rav's son, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, in an interview with the author, with Rabbi Deitch. He's now quoting my classmate, Reb Chaim. In fact, the previous Rebbe was ultimately the deciding factor in my father getting the job. The committee was split in their opinion about my father. One of the members of the committee was Mr. Abraham Mirza, a well-known New York philanthropist. He was also a very big supporter of Lubavitch. The previous Rebbe called Mr. Mirza and asked him to support my father. His vote was the key factor in the committee's decision to offer my father the job. Okay? No, I asked you, what does this tell you? It shows you that the sixth Rebbe, his relationship with the Rav, the role model he sought for his own son-in-law, it was a beautiful, warm relationship. And this is Reb Chaim speaking, who has a negative view, as we will see, of the Rav and the seventh Rebbe. But this is Reb Chaim speaking. It's a fact. But I'll go one step further. No, I've proved to you the Rebbe loved the Rav. How do I know the Rav loved the Rebbe? And here you come. And this is a very, very important document. And I have a big schut in the outfall of the document. Eli, Chabad had a picture in its archives. Have you ever been to the Chabad archives, 770, the library, the inner sanctuary? They're very organized today after the 1980s and the theft and the trial and all that went on 35 years ago. They're very organized. They had a picture, a fabulous picture, of a state senator speaking, state assemblyman, whoever, a politician, a Jew, and sitting at the head table, as we say in Yiddish, Ebenon, up front, the sixth Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, Rav Shmaya Gur Aryeh, the brother-in-law of the seventh Rebbe, the man who perhaps should have been Rebbe, according to us, many members of the family, as we've spoken about and will speak about. And there's one person sitting there, a young man with a black beard, and no one but no one in the entire empire of Chabad knew who that person was. And then some dummy living in Israel published a two-volume set on the Rav, the world of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. I don't think the person who wrote it never got credit for that work. You should know he was attacked on all sides instead of people realizing what he was writing, what he was doing. Don't ask. But Baruch Hashem, the work is now in a fifth or sixth printing. I can tell you the author doesn't get a penny because the Ketav sold out to Israelis, and the author tracked down, who do you talk to? And I know the books are being sold. I know people buying them. And that's like my sitting here and asking for a case of Ben and Jerry's ice cream to enjoy life. All right? I can ask all I want. Charlie, I don't see Ben and Jerry's getting here within the hour, even if the intentions are good. Gentlemen, that young man who put out that two-volume set had a photo section on the Rav. People ate his, what are you, a chassid? What do you need all those pictures for? You claim it's a book of scholarship. I can tell you what the author answered. He said, this is a book for those who love the Rav. And if you love the Rav, yes, we are also a bit of chassidim, despite our Litvish background, and we want pictures of the Rav. And among the pictures, the author of that book was privileged. He has a Talmud, a character par excellence. He was here for the Hesped for Rabbi Horowitz. Yosef Klausner, Yedidja, I think is the last name he goes by. He wants me to speak in his shul in front. I told him I don't have energy. Have mercy on me. And do you know him, Jay?
He was my
classmate. Well, he's about... Right, and now your age, he never married, never found a girl who was good enough. You at least picked the Machon Gold girl then, Baruch Hashem. You're not looking back. He's married to my student. But the Klaus, he was once going with a student of mine, and she broke it off, and she married a widow, I believe, with five children afterwards. So the Klaus is the Klaus, a genius. But geniuses, you gotta be able to walk on 10 toes. So the Klaus gives me a picture. His mother, I yet knew his mother. His mother was so capable, Hebrew, English, Yiddish, interchangeably, reading, writing, everything. She was the secretary of the Var Hatzalah. She was a genius. I knew her. His mother had a picture of the Rav from 1939, speaking at a Mizrahi convention with an American flag behind him, whatever, the Klaus gave me that picture. That's one of the pictures I published in the Rav. Someone in 770 opened up the volume and he sees the picture of the Rav 1939 with a little black beard. And he opens up the archives and he pulls out the picture from 1942. And lo and behold, the other person sitting there was Moriu Rebbe, Rebbe Yosef Dov, Halevi Soloveitchik. And I want to say to Chabad, they contacted me, they thanked me, and they said, you will have the right to be the first one to publish it. In other words, as a real picture. It went on internets, but as a real picture, the first time it appears with a thank you to Chabad is in Washington. And that's why I tell people, by Washington, the author, believe me, if you would know what I get out of it, 200 shekel a year. God, they have a system here in Israel. They don't tell me any books they sell. They tell me how much they spent and how much came in. And it were 27,000 shekel spent, 27,200 came in. What do you mean you spent? Anyone who orders a book in China and they have to send it by mail, I pay the postage. You follow me? If they have to deliver it to Tel Aviv, to a bookstore. I never saw people like this. They know how to joke you for it. But Baruch Hashem, thank God, I have enough for coffee and cake if I want, or milk and bread for the rest of my life. Baruch Hashem. No complaints whatsoever. What do you say? Pizza?
Matzah pizza.
God. Delicious, delicious. Okay, back here. So I published, I say to people, if you're depressed over what the heck goes on in our Torah world in Israel, believe me, there's so much to be depressed about. The infighting, the cursing, the malediction, not voting. Buy the book and look at the picture of the Rav sitting with the two Rebbes. But more than that, so the Rav sat with the two Rebbes. Shush! The Rav was the main speaker. And he praised the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe. He spoke about, I quoted in great detail in the article I wrote, we'll come to it, but not yet. But the gist of the article, that the Gemara describes a miracle that someone, that a young lady put kerosene, instead of kerosene to burn the Shabbos candles, vinegar. And they lit the candles, and the vinegar beautifully burned, the miracle. He describes the sixth Rebbe came to America, vinegar, and he lit the candles, and the candles are burning in the United States. Now, believe me, you don't say that about someone unless you admire that person. So there is no question that the Rav and the sixth Rebbe and the seventh Rebbe had a very, very unique relationship that continues throughout Berlin and into America. Now, in this chapter, Chaim Soloveitchik and Rabbi Deutsch both make the same point that the Soloveitchik family, the Huttner family, were frightened by the messianic overtones of Lubavitch. It already begins before America, but certainly takes on intensity in the United States. One of the earliest campaigns of the Lubavitcher Rebbe was to raise money in America. We're talking now the sixth Rebbe already, to write a Torah for Mashiach Tzidkenu. Afterwards, it is reported, and people told me they lived the era where the Rebbe spoke in terms of the quicker we do Geula, the sooner Mashiach will come. I want to find if there's a photograph here. La'alta l'tshuva, la'alta l'geula. That was an expression coined by the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe. Immediately do tshuva, immediately Mashiach will come. Now this raises a very delicate question. Bididi havi uvda. It happened to me. 1973, BMT was on Rehov Ababonel, Rehov Ibn Ezra. The school had taken root. We had some fabulous faculty members. Labriot, the Yom Kippur War broke out. The Yom Kippur War broke out in Yom Kippur. It was a moment in time that anyone who lived it will never forget. Walking to BMT from my house to Daven, and I Davened in BMT until my grandchildren, twins, were born, when we had to help my daughter take care of them. That was 24 years ago. I always Davened all the previous years. I Davened in BMT, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Ababonel, Neely, and finally here. Walking to shul that Yom Kippur morning, I see a car, a woman driving it. Woman looked familiar to me. I couldn't understand driving a car in Yom Kippur. Turned out she just died, Lo Aleinu. She was the head nurse at Shaarei Tzedek, and she was called into the hospital. It was the morning. Then I thought I heard planes overhead. Very strange in Kippur. And then, towards the end of Musaf, it was after one, a kid who was living across the street, nothing to do with BMT, but an English speaking was from London, ran in hysterically, war has broken out. A minute later, sound trucks were going up and down the streets, turn on your radio. And within minutes, miluim units after miluim units were being called up, codes were being announced, and our own madrichim were leaving to go to the battlefront. Two of our madrichim never returned. Birnbaum and Stern. Shem Yikom Damo. It's very traumatic. And school continues. Sukkot came. We didn't call off classes outside of students who volunteered to deliver mail, to work in kibbutzim. Everyone around, we said, come, we'll have shiur. One of the teachers who goes on to an illustrious career in the rabbinate, or illustrious calling, I should say, as a rav in Bat Yam, some of you may recognize the name, Harav David Chai Kohen, who is one of the big Svadik Rabbanim, has an entire set of educational institutions in Bat Yam. Rav David Chai Kohen was teaching in BMT. Rav David Chai Kohen had a unique background. BMT is Bet Medrash LaTorah. It's the first school cater. We spoke about it, but it was all in Hebrew the other night when Rabbi Hurwitz was the first dean, Whitey Hurwitz, Moshe Hurwitz. I spoke about it. If you know Hebrew, it's Kedai. Ask Rab Shua if it went up yet on the website. It's Kedai to listen to you with excellent, excellent talks. So Rav David Chai Kohen has a very interesting background. Obviously, he's Rav David Chai, I believe he's Taimani, Makar, studied in KBY, was at Sanchan in the army, Hezder, studied in Mechaz HaRav, Talmud Mufak of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, and other Rosh Yeshiva in Mechaz, Rav Ranan at the time, Rav Cook's son-in-law, Seichel Tzikonim Sadikim Levracha, marries an American girl who had come in Aliyah, the granddaughter of Reb Lezer Silva, the daughter of Reb David Silva of Harrisburg. And the boys loved him. I would say if there were two popular Rebbeim in BMT, one was a guy from the Bronx originally, we shan't mention his name, and the other person was Reb David Chai Kohen. And Chol HaMoed, I'll never forget, he gives a shir al pi Kabbalah, proving that this is Muhammad Gog Magog, and Mashiach Tzidkenu is around the corner. Well, the students came to me, Rebbe, what do you think? And you see, here's a very delicate problem. On one hand, if you don't believe in Mashiach, you're not a good Jew, right or wrong. On the other hand, if we raise messianic hopes, and Mashiach doesn't show, the results can be very negative, very disastrous. Give me an example from Jewish history, the simplest example of all, Shabtai Tzvi. Here was Shabtai Tzvi, and by the way, Shabtai Tzvi was a tzaddik in Bechol Terachav, in his own personal behavior, absolutely. But we're talking when he declared himself Mashiach, the Polish Rabbanim sent spies and they couldn't find, the only thing they found wrong is that when he was asleep, they found him sleeping on his back, pakbanit, which you're not allowed. I don't want to say why the lady's sitting here. But and even that, a malamit schut, that doesn't mean he went to sleep that way. He turned over in the middle of his sleep. We go to sleep on one side, we wake up on the other side. But he was a tzaddik. There were the Gedolei Polish Jewry, Gedolei Israel, were in doubt. Who is he? What is he? And then suddenly he's not Mashiach, and it's he becomes a Mohammedan. And you know, all right, it's a lot has been written. I'm not the great expert in the field. I don't have to tell you how many great people at Hebrew U have dealt with Shabtai Tzvi. You can spend 7 years reading the volumes on Shabtai Tzvi, the doctorates that have been done. But the end result was the Jews that were so uplifted after the Chmielnytsky massacres now fell to the ground. And this is how Hasidus comes on the world, which actually saves the Jewish people of Poland, at least greater Poland, from mass spiritual, I would say, suicide is the proper word. Now, this is a very delicate issue. And I told the students, B'zeh HaLashon, I hope Rabbi David Chai Cohn is right, but I'm not certain. I don't want to raise your hopes. What if Mashiach doesn't come? What if this isn't Milchemet Gog or Magog? I don't want you to throw all of Yiddishkeit away and say it's a farce. And that's why I'm diffident and hesitant to agree with Rabbi David Chai Cohn, although I love him, loved him, terrific individual. Now, coming to Chabad, there's no question that we believe in Mashiach. Look at the stories we're told about the Chafetz Chaim. Every morning he pulled up the shades in his apartment to see whether Mashiach had come. Are we going to criticize the Chafetz Chaim for that? Look how we introduced the Limud Kodshim to be ready for the Beit HaMikdash. Are we going to criticize the Chafetz Chaim? So you see, this is a very delicate question. Thousands of Chabadnikim are shouting, we want Mashiach now, we want Mashiach now. How do you react? And there is no question that there's not a black and white answer to this. Rav Huttner, and this is documented by Deutsch, and I can tell you I've heard this from students who lived it, Rav Huttner was furious when in Metifta Chaim Berlin, Mesifta Chaim Berlin, which he already was heading up and was starting to develop as Rabbi Huttner's school, Rabbi Huttner's high school, Rabbi Huttner's Metifta, Rabbi Huttner's yeshiva, someone put up signs, La'alta, La'tshuva, La'alta, Geula. He ripped the sign off. And he warned Chabad, if they ever put up signs like that again, he'll throw at any student in Chaim Berlin who is a Chabadnik. Remember, this is before Chabad had its own massive educational institutions. And this is true about Rabbi Huttner 100%. He and the Seventh Rebbe had a lot in common. He and the Seventh Rebbe knew each other from Berlin. He and the Seventh Rebbe studied together, had a seder together. Their minds were terrific. In the 40s, when the Rebbe was working in the Navy Yard in Brooklyn, but afterwards, when the Rebbe became Rebbe and was so preoccupied, their study sessions ended. But there was a lingering resentment or fear or diffidence because of Chabad's stress on Mashiach. Now, you have to understand, this gets caught up in Chabad's own theology. What did Chabad believe? And this is something every person who does research on Chabad has to deal with. What did Chabad believe? There'll only be seven Rebbeim. Well, what is the implication? There'll only be seven Rebbeim, and then Mashiach will come? Nowadays, the Rebbe died 1994. We're 21 years afterwards. There were only seven Rebbeim. Mashiach hasn't come. This was one of the impediments why there was no successor or not even serious talk about a successor to the seventh Rebbe. Because Chabad, only seven Rebbeim. If there are only seven Rebbeim, there can't be an eighth Rebbe, and yet Mashiach is not yet here. Now, I spoke with a very balanced Talmud of Rav Huttner, who yet was very close to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in Chaim Berlin. He lives in Yerushalayim today, a man with a lot of knowledge, lo aleinu, not in the best of health anymore, a man whose life was total dedication to Torah, and he spoke in terms of a quagmire that Chabad dug itself into by saying seven Rebbeim. Well, the seventh Rebbe dies, there's no success. And we'll come back to this, Shashi. You can,
why seven?
Why seven? That's an interesting question. Our entire book was written, Hashviyi, because seven is a very sanctified number. So Shabbat, seven, the seven spheres, it's endless. An entire book was written. But you see, there is a quagmire here, and there is a difficulty, and you can be choshesh. On the other hand, Chabad is fabulous. It resuscitated belief in Mashiach. It resuscitated belief in the unique Jewish destiny. He made it clear to every Jew who didn't know anything about Yiddishkeit that we are not like the Catholics, we are not like the Protestants. For us, Mashiach has not yet come. And if you become good Jews, you pave the way for Mashiach's coming. And if anyone will ask me on this day, on this beautiful Monday, on this beautiful classroom with my wonderful students sitting in front of me, are we closer to the Mashiach period? Absolutely. Every minute that goes by, we are closer. But like a litvak, when? That's in God's hands. Can you overstress it? Do we understress it? How do we balance it? There can be many opinions.
All of our prayers.
Of course.
Many times a day.
Theoretically,
we're supposed to be thinking about it.
Ani mamin. Did you want to ask anything? I'll tell you.
I just want to ask, when did that number seven get announced? Was that by the first Rebbe?
I can't answer you. You probably will find the answer. I'll come to the volume next year. I'll quote it. Hashvi'i. He probably deals with that. I don't recall. My guess is that it becomes pronounced with the seventh Rebbe.
I don't think that was an idea.
It becomes pronounced, becomes widespread, becomes accepted. This is why they chose the Rebbe. The Rebbe didn't have children. And yet, everyone is living with it. The seventh will be the final. This is like the end of the week. This is the ultimate achievement. Ke'ein olam haba, Shabbat, an eternal Shabbat. Yes.
We speak of the Messianic camp within Chabad.
Right.
But do we have any evidence that the Rebbe himself...
We'll come to that, but not now. I just want to deal now with the Rebbe and the Rebbe. I have a lot prepared on that. I'll open your eyes, but it's too early. Not yet. I'll tell you one story. If you want to see how far this goes, and this story captures our generation. I don't want to talk about myself. I don't know how I get involved, but what can I do? My wife and I have one mitzvah that no one in this class has, no one in this building has. Very few people in the world have this mitzvah. Pidyon Shvuyim, certified by the Mossad. And I don't believe the Mossad tells lies, at least not in Tel Aviv or Yerushalayim. So, you know, we were taken in when we went to Russia the first time, 1980, January 1981. We were taken in by this family in Moscow. We were just captivated by their devotion, by their intelligence, the Essas family. And I write about it in Washington. We went to work, whatever. I don't want to go into details, but I learned how to contact the President of the United States. I learned whether or not you should contact the President of the United States. Sometimes it's an overkill. I learned very quickly the ins and outs of how you do something in the political world and the economic world as well. And everyone laughed at me, and my handler in the Mossad looked on and said, you'll never accomplish it. Anyway, a number of years later, I got a call, Erev Shabbos Kodesh Pasha told that 1985, and you got to know who said that to me, a man who later wins Pras Yisrael. Okay. Now, you got to understand Elia Essas. Elia Essas was born in Vilna. Notice his name, Eliyahu Essas. Ilya Essas. It's Eliyahu. Parents, totally irreligious. I don't know if they were communist. I don't think so. But, you know, brought up without any Torah. He had great uncles who were Rashi Yeshiva and the Litvashi Yeshiva. His family didn't grow up on a barren tree, obviously. And somehow from communism, he has permission to use the inner part of the Lenin Library, that's like the National Library in Moscow. He has a PhD in mathematics, and he finds the Book of Iov. He finds histories of the Jews, books that only certain people had access to. And he finds out he's Jewish, what it means to be a Jew. So he becomes a Zionist. He wants to leave Russia. Plies, early 70s. They don't let him out because his wife worked with some radio technology. And you know the old story, you know secrets. So you would answer the KGB, what do you mean I know secrets? This is technology outdated. The Western world is way beyond this. Yes, yes, that's exactly the secret you know. That's why we can't let you out. So they can't get out. They're going to Israel. So you see, I've said this so many times. Had the communists allowed the Jews out when they wanted to leave, no one would have been free. Only the Chabadnikim. In Russia, they were Chabadnikim. That's a different story. I'm talking about beyond Chabad in Russia. So these refusenikim are now boiling away in their oil. They can't get a job. They can't work. They run the fear of being arrested as parasites. So they start to ask, why are we suffering because we're Jews? Well, when you start to ask, you have to study. And a whole underground develops. They start to study, and with the aid of the Mossad, they find out to be a Jew. Shabbat, Kashrut, Tarat Mishpacha, religious Zionism, etc., etc. And Elia now is on the road back. Many stories I can tell you about him. That's a very interesting personality. Should live and be well. There was just a big write-up about him, either in the Mishpacha or in Ami, one of the recent issues. I think the Sukkos issue of Bamishpacha had a big write-up of Elia today. So he now comes to Yiddishkeit. He learns about the Vilna Gaon. He learns about the fight with the Hasidim. And finally, a family named Rakefet succeeds in getting him out. I have to say, my success was due to Bronfman. Ultimately, I was able to reach Bronfman through Izzy Singer. They deserve credit. I deserve credit, obviously, but they deserve credit. And Izzy Singer, Musmach of Torah Vidas, he gets Bronfman involved, and Bronfman is involved now in a $100 million deal. By today's money, it'd be a $1 billion deal with the Soviet government to sell their vodka, to push their vodka through Seagram's distribution, and this Jew, semi-assimilated, but now a Jew, belay v'nefesh, not frum, but a Jew, identity, makes a condition that the deal will only go through if the Essos family is allowed out. And the Russian government, for $1 billion, out you go. And Elia now reaches Israel, and there was big publicity here. I had contacts. I had the newspapers. What went on at the airport? There was a whole TV program. And I take him to Tel Aviv the first time, and people recognize him on the speech. You know, it went on. They buy him soda, this, that. It was unbelievable. Amcha Yisrael, we're the greatest people in the world when we don't fight. When we fight, we're idiots. But we're the greatest people. You see what went on in what's the country there? We're just now, the earthquake. Not Nepal, Nepal. You see what went on in Nepal. And you should know, many of the doctors and nurses were religious people, were Jews from our camp. It's unbelievable. And with Chabad, they all said without Chabad, we couldn't have done it. The field hospital and everything set up in Chabad. Ah. So now we're at a wedding. At a wedding together. And at the wedding, they're singing, what's the name? Mashiach, Mashiach, something, give me the idea. Yeah, let me hear it.
Mashiach,
Mashiach, Mashiach. Yeah. That's the song. And Elia is furious. And he sits down and he's looking at me. How dare you dance? And he says, this is Chabad, this is the ruination, and the false hope. And I saw there the head-on clash, the Neshama, right? The Gilgal of the Gaon of Vilna, Rabbeinu Eliyahu, is in Rabbeinu Eliyahu, who just got out of Vilna. And I could see the Anamasa. And it's a delicate, who's right? A delicate question. But Shashi, I want you to know, the Ribbono Shel Olam runs the world. What I told you is absolutely true. Now, the Yesasas have among their children only one daughter. Okay? That daughter meets a boy, Minretir Ashidach. Let me speak a little Mamalashan. And the boy is a Gera Chassid. That's only part of it. His eldest son, Yosef, meets a girl who came to study. Girl, parents, Russian. The girl's born in L.A. Russian origins. No Yiddishkeit. Who do you think picked the girl up? Chabad. And they make a shidduch with Elia's oldest son. And at the shidduchim, the ceremony, the suda, the erusin, call it whatever you want. One speaker, a guy named Rakefet. But this Rakefet doesn't forget. He gets up and looks them right in the eyes. And he says, Rabbeinu Eliyahu, you think you're a Litvak. You think you're from Vilna. You refuse to sing Mashiach. But the Ribbono Shel Olam is slapping your face now. And he has to sit there and everyone is hysterical. I said, your eldest son, how did his wonderful wife become from? Chabad. Your daughter now? Akira Chassid. And the father-in-law, the Mechutin, is looking at me and he's hysterical. And poor Elia, what can he do? He can't cut me off and call me an apikaris. Pigeon shvuim. He can't cut me off and call me an apikaris. It's his children. So you see, the Ribbono Shel Olam equals the score. So it's a very, very fascinating chapter in his book. What did the Rav think about the seventh Rebbe? Now, Chaim makes the point that the seventh Rebbe and the Rav had a small relationship in Berlin. I would agree that it was not on a daily basis. They didn't learn together. I would agree that the Rebbe's relationship with Rabbi Huttner was a lot more intense because it begins in Berlin and continues in Brooklyn, where they lived door to door to each other, if not in the same neighborhood, but one bus ride away, one or two stops on the subway, etc. I would agree. I cannot doubt the fact that the Mashiach factor played a role with Rabbi Huttner, but I'm not certain that we can say it played a role with the Rav. Mashiach Tzidkenu, Seder Kodshim, I'm told, and I don't know how true it is, Benjamin Brown, if you recognize the name, fine. If you don't recognize the name, one day we'll talk about him in detail. Anyone here know him personally? I believe he lives in Beit Shemesh. Benjamin Brown, who did that magnificent doctorate on the Chazon Ish, published by Hebrew U and Cardoza Law School. How Cardoza gets involved, I don't know, but evidently Benjamin Brown taught at Cardoza or gave guest lectures at Cardoza. The man has to be a Gaon. He came out with Benjamin Brown. I never met him, but I'm blown away by his scholarship. You can find the criticism here, there, people take it, but the work on the Chazon Ish over 900 pages of Lamdanut and the Rav, and by the way, his whole description of the interchange with the Rav is absolutely correct. So Benjamin Brown, in a little volume that came out a few years ago on the Haredi world and Das Torah, makes the point that Rav Shach criticized Brisk for learning only Kodshim. That Rav Shach criticized Brisk. So, you know, I want to leave this issue open. What does your humble servant hold? Very simply, there's nothing wrong with singing Mashiach, Mashiach. There's probably nothing wrong with saying, I want Mashiach now. I think we say it every day when we say Ani Mamin. But to overstress it and make you feel that tomorrow Mashiach will be here, I am hesitant, I am diffident. And that's what I said to my students about Rabbi David Chai Cohen. Let me end off the class. Following the negative approach of Reb Chaim, or semi-negative, call it as you wish, in Deutsch, very fascinating chapter. Let me quote someone who all of you know, and all of you have heard him speak and give shayurim, and that is someone I grew up with in the Bronx, who when DiMaggio hit a home run, his apartment shook, because his father left Philadelphia to come to New York to take a little shtela so that his son could get a yeshiva education, and that apartment was about three blocks from Yankee Stadium. The name of this person, you know him as Harav Tzvi Shachta. His wife knows him as Heschel. I know him as Heshi. Arnie, that's what his mother called him, Heshi. Look into Divrei Harav. Divrei Harav, I believe that was the last volume of the three where he writes about the Rav, Nefesh Harav, what's the other one? Divrei Harav, Penine Harav. Now, Rav Heschel puts together, it's a very, very valuable, I would say, Asufat Maimarim. How would you say that in English? Very valuable compendium of the Rav, how he understood the Rav, what he heard from the Rav, and he has here in this volume, beginning on page, let me give you the pages, beginning on page 108, a whole essay, a whole discourse on the Rav and Chabad. What I'm interested in are 2 points. Number one, he writes about, and he doesn't give sources, and I've spoken with him about this, and something I've spoken about in class many times. You all know that the sixth Rebbe gave a whole talk on Shah Shenagach Etapara, the Yetzer Hara beat up on the Yetzer Hatov. Reb Aaron Cutler heard about this talk, and Reb Aaron Cutler went hysterical. This is apikursis. You have no right to take halacha and turn it into allegory. You are an apikoros.
Only if you said it was only allegory.
Relax, relax. You don't have to defend the law. At this point, the Lubavitcher Rebbe does not need our defense. I can give you a slew of proofs that there's nothing wrong and even magnificent what the Rebbe did. But that's not the point. Rabarin the Litvak. How dare you? Dare you? So, there is a story circulating that they asked the Rav to write a rebuttal because the Rav was very close to the sixth Rebbe, and the story goes that the Rav wrote a rebuttal that appeared in the New England Rabbinic Journal under the name Zamir. What does Zamir mean? Nightingale. What does Soloveitchik mean? Nightingale. Why do they have the name Soloveitchik? Because in Polish it means nightingale, and they're Levium, and Levium have to sing in the Beit HaMikdash. And the Rav Dafka didn't have a bad voice, particularly in his middle age. It was very nice. I heard him then. Later on, we all grow older. I mean, I didn't have a voice to begin with, but I have some grandsons I can't get over. How good? Where the heck did they get that voice from? Those that are artists, I know where they got it from. My wife is an artist. I have the grandsons that are on the level of Picasso, in my opinion. But they're unbelievable in their innovativeness, not just their ability. But where do they get that? I don't know. Anyway, so the Rav wrote this article under the name Zamir. Rav Heschel admits that article has never, ever been found. Anyone ever see it? I've looked for it. Others have looked for it. We've looked. We've haunted. We've looked into haunted houses. We've hunted for it. B'nei Rot. No one has ever come up with that article.
How do they know that it really
existed? I'm doubting it. I'm just telling you black and white that I don't want to say it's a fairy tale, but it appears to me to be a fairy tale. What's interesting, and Heschel and Rav Shechter does mention this, that when these Divrei Torah were reissued by the seventh Rebbe, and I have to see if it's in the two-volume set you gave me, so there's a footnote on the sixth Rebbe's Torah that giving a makar for it to Reb Chaim Vital. Yeah. You follow? So once you give him a makar to Reb Chaim Vital, it's like I got angry an hour and a half ago. Angry, I mean, how do they attack me for misquoting the Rebbe if I'm quoting Rabbi Steinsaltz? Attack him. So by giving him a makar for Reb Chaim Vital, what does it mean? What you're saying is, if you have a problem with it, go back to Reb Chaim Vital. Don't find the problem with the sixth Rebbe. But I have to tell you, just to let Alex relax and rebuild his glass house. Alex, you know how much has been written on Hasidic? Mossad Rav Kook came out with magnificent volumes on Hasidic allegorical interpretations of the Talmud, I believe of Nach as well. So you have to look. But the volume on the Talmud is fabulous. And never forget the first example of a Hasidic interpretation. Alex knows all of Shas, so he decided he wants to learn Hasidus. So he comes to a Rebbe, Shmuel Shmuel, the story is told, comes to a Rebbe and he says, I'll teach you Shas, you teach me Hasidus, Kabbalah. Fine. So the Rebbe says, well, Torah Tanigler is the basis, that comes before Torah Tanista. Let's begin with Shas. Where do we begin, Alex says? Alex says, I'm beginning from Brachot. Begin. May Aymatai Korinet Hashma Shalavet. And Alex starts to explain. Every mitzvah has a time framework. May Aymatai, what time do you read it? And the Rebbe gets hysterical. Yuranam Arex, an Oisvaf. You don't know Pshatna Mishnah. May Ema Tai Korinat Hashma, May Ema Umiyira Korinat Hashma. Follow? That's the first example. Here's Rav Shmuel Shmuel. It's a meritic thought. And if you ever teach Masechet Brachot, you begin May Ema Tai, May Ema Umiyira. Then you can go into Ema. I don't want these kids to learn, oh, come today, come tomorrow. This is the basis. They have Chiloni Batei Medrash here. Without Shabbat, without Kashrut, without Tarish Mishpacha, you are not living a Jewish life. I'm not opposed. Halavai learn Shas, but the Shas, you have to become a Jew. This is to say, I know. She quoted a Gemara, the last Knesset, remember? It doesn't make you, all right, thank God she can quote a Gemara. It's better than quoting Roman literature. But one has to understand what Yiddishkeit is about. There's one other point here. Let me end off. And again, I throw it open to research. Rav Heschel writes, see, he writes without sources at times. So, yeah, all right, the Rav too could tell a Hasidic story and not give a source. And I went to Bernard River graduate school, so it was very hard for me to open my mouth without giving a source. If I open my mouth and don't give a source, I'll be attacked. I misquote it, miss this. Or I always say, I did not research this. In other words, I'm only telling you what I've heard. Okay. He says here, let me give you the exact page, Resh Yud Zayin, 217. So he says here that the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe declared a campaign, K'tivat Sefer Torah Lekrat Melech HaMashiach. And he says, among those who opposed the Rebbe was Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. Now, I have one tremendous problem with this. My dear students, when did the Rebbe arrive in America? March 19th, 1940. I don't believe he began immediately declaring he's writing a Sefer Torah for Mashiach Tzidkenu. He arrived in America, they went to the hotel, the Hasidim tried to talk him out of being a Rebbe in America, tried to put him into Lakewood, retire him, you all know the story. Then he decided, 770, the Crown Heights, the conservative temple is there, find me a house. They found a house. I don't know. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik did not function, basically, after December 1940. Rabbi Revel died, my cousin died. Yeshiva was in pandemonium. The great attack upon the Rav. Reb Moshe takes ill. I don't know. Can someone please check when the 6th Rebbe announced his campaign to write a Torah for Mashiach Tzidkenu? I see a very narrow time slot between his arrival in America and when Reb Moshe died. So I wish I would have a source. Reb Moshe took issue. What's the source? How do we know it? Is it possible? And if we find out that this campaign to write a Torah for Mashiach Tzidkenu is dated 42, 43, 45, then these lines are absolutely not correct, because Reb Moshe wasn't alive then. And the truth is, 1 year after Reb Moshe died, the Rav gives that magnificent talk at the dinner for the Tomchei Tamimim Yeshiva that the Rebbe is beginning in the United States. So let me iterate, a lot of food for thought, a lot to think about. I throw the challenge out. Maybe it can be checked out historically. Yeah, do you have?
On Chabad's website, they say that the running the Sefer Torah for the greeting of Mashiach initiated the behest of the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1942.
So that already did, exactly. So you've just disproven.
Concluded 28 years later after that.
And conclude. Thank you.
Where was that?
I am the Chabad website. I want to tell you the greatest invention. My mother was asked, my mother lived to be almost 100 years, and she was asked, the grandchildren always asked, Bubby, what was the greatest thing that happened in your life? And they thought she would say airplanes, etc. She said, the greatest thing that happened in my life was indoor plumbing. And I still remember visiting apartments on the east side of my uncles and aunts, my great uncles, great aunts, where you had to go out to go to the bathroom, you had to go into the hallway, or you had to go around the side of the house. Just think what life was like. I want to tell you that I stand in awe of the knowledge that Harav Hagon Google has. I tell you, I stand in awe. If there ever was a Gaon, it's Harav Google, and I claim there's no way to teach Torah, to learn Torah, to research Torah, to inspire Torah without the computer. And you just saw it in action. 1 minute ago, the question I asked, so Rakefet's feeling, I couldn't see him doing it in 40. 41, Reb Moshe was gone. 42, Reb Moshe was gone. So if anyone is in communication with Reb Heschel, please mention to him the knowledge we've concluded. So what have we done today? Only the first part. I dealt with the more negative approach to the Rav and the Rebbe. I challenge you to study Deutsch, and see the sources. And next week, I want to deal with a more positive approach. And I have many, many solid sources. There's one part of Reb Chaim's interview where he says something where I will show, and I'll deal with it next week, where it turns out there's a 10-year difference between what Reb Chaim is saying and what happened. Unless it happened twice, but we don't have record of it, it would seem that the more positive approach is absolutely correct. My dear students, let me just talk about the immediate future. Again, I hope Mashiach will be here, but if Mashiach is not here by next week, it's our last two classes of this month. There is class on Yom Yerushalayim. I've heard already a little bit of butcheraya. How do you say that in English? Complaints, criticism, critique. But I don't run the kollel. I'm only a humble teacher on principle. I don't get involved in anything beyond my classroom because I don't have time for machlekes and discussion, etc., etc. Yeah, but they're marching to the Kotel with the Galim. If you haven't seen that, it's unbelievable to see the youth, to see the children we raised here, to see the dedication. It's a great achievement. Baruch Hashem, my kids are bigger Zionists than I am. You have to understand that. It's a big achievement. Kanayin Hara. So, with all due respect to our Kefet, his class does not cancel Yom Yerushalayim, but if I have to give, I'm going to give. But I'm going to give next week. Sunday's class is once in a lifetime. What I incurred with Erev, I'm going to end off with art. You won't believe you. I couldn't believe my eyes, and you won't believe your ears. And if I have time, I'll say a few words about the election and what it teaches us, a bit in Yonah Diyoma, if time allows. Next Monday, Be'ezrat Hashem, I pick up on the Rebbe and a more positive approach, the Rav and the Rebbe, and I'll show you some very interesting documents. Next year, we'll pick up whenever the Kollel comes in, whatever, we'll contact everyone, let you know. In this class, we continue exactly where we left off. We have a world yet to do on the history of Torah in the United States. I have to finish Lubavitch and Dignity, which will take many more months. And then I want to deal with the rabbinate in the new world. A very fascinating topic. And all right, I have to get it out of my system. So we'll deal with that. In the Sunday class, I'm totally switching gears. Until now, I've spent 2 years on a Reuven, 5 years on the Holocaust, 2.5 years on the classic Haguna, etc., etc., etc. Beginning next Zman, I'm doing Kol HaTorah Kula. The Ribbono Shel Olam has to keep me going to the age of 240. I'm using Rav Menashe Klein's responsima as a source for viewing the Jew in the 20th century. And one thing I will guarantee you, in all those lectures, no one, but no one, will ever fall asleep. Even my wife sees me laughing and preparing and Xeroxing and working. And she goes, what are you working on? And when I tell her, she's, wow, it's like I conder into, with the Hesped on Rebaron Lichtenstein. I told her, tonight I'm talking about Phil Cavaretto. And she says, who was he? I said, that's going to be only at the... She actually went to YouTube and heard and watched my whole lecture. But in Stamford, Connecticut, I'm going to deal with Phil Cavaretta, and I'm also going to deal with Rabbi Lesnar with the 1934 All-Star Game. If anyone wants, here is a sample of the new Steinsaltz coming out by Koren. It is unbelievable what they're doing. Here is a sample of Metifta, Talmud Bavli, Masechet Pesachim. It's unbelievable. I was born before my time. I'm learning Shkalim now. Malka looks at me using the Shkalim I have. She says, this is what they have today. Any baby can master it. Here's a beautiful picture of the Rebbetzin Chaya Mashka being driven by a chassid to view the Lag BaOmer parade on Eastern Parkway. Here is a Chabad document. Let's see if you people know anything about Chabad. This is a Talmud I picked up years ago through the website. A big Talmud Chacham, his father's a Rosh Yeshiva. Now, this is his wedding invitation. It says, B'sha'at ha'chamishit, with an asterisk, and underneath it says 3:30 Kabbalat Panim, 5 o'clock the Chuppah. What does it mean, B'sha'at ha'chamishit? Does anyone know? That's the, look how nobody knows, wow. Correct me if I'm wrong, Chabadnikim listening. If I'm not wrong, I believe Tzvi Groner taught me, this was the original invitation for the Lubavitcher Rebbe's wedding to Chaya Mashka. It read B'shat HaChamishit, which meant 5 p.m. in the afternoon. Every real Chabadnik writes B'shat HaChamishit with an asterisk to let you know when the time really is. Here is, has anyone seen the picture in my office of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, like waving? Did anyone ever see that? You can come to my office with me now. So that picture, how is it taken? I'm going to meet the photographer again in Toronto, and I'll be in Toronto now. So he was a Baal Tshuva, and he comes to Chabad. He's a photographer, and he's trying to take a picture of the Rebbe, and the Rebbe turns and looks at him and says, Nushein, mach the bild, already, make the picture. Here I got a girl, comes from London, 11 years old, with her father to see the Rebbe, and she's waiting outside where he's going to come down from his office to daven to take his picture, and she's so hesitant, she pachajirat covered, and the Rebbe turns to her and says, mach the bild, take the picture. That's a picture of the Rebbe of an 11, taken by an 11-year-old girl. Now, do you remember I came back from Florida and I was letting steam, fire, hail, and brimstone out of my mouth that I speak with this kid who is a son of a Talmud. He's in YU. He's bawling mad at YU. They don't let girls up to the dorm. He's now living in his own apartment. They're held at YU. He can do whatever he wants. There is now a letter to parents from Kenny Brander. This is Rabbi Kenny Brander. It's not a lightweight. The head, the man, vice president, pleading with parents that a new trend has developed. Kids are living outside the dorm. Who knows what the heck they are doing? If Bill Clinton can do what he does, why can't these kids do what they do? They'll also be presidents of the United States. This is funny. This is Josh Schneider. Remember, I mentioned Reb Chaim Moshe Gorelick, his brother, his younger brother died. He's alive and kicking. He's giving a shiur. And here it says, and he's in his 70s, Reb Chaim Moshe, born in 1940 or 41. And here he's now going to also give a shiur and say the kachim, what he learned with Maran Hagon, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi, Zeicher Tzadik Kadosh Levach Chaim Amarba. Gentlemen, ladies, what does he mean? My poor student Josh Schneider is going into orbit. They're quoting the Rav Hagon, Reb Yosef Dov Hagrid. Oh, yeah, I had to write him an email this morning. My dear student, you are confusing the Rav with his first cousin. Reb Chaim Moshe Gorelick is a Talmud of Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, the eldest son of Reb Velvel, the Briska Rav. Very fascinating. Another Talmud of mine via the website, a very brilliant fellow, insightful. He's in Riverdale today. A lawyer, big position, but he knows everything going on in Israel. His analysis of the coalition, a coalition scorecard. I wrote back, very fascinating. Only one problem, morning. I wrote back to him, you're missing one point. Ultimately, the Supreme Court controls the state of Israel. And wait till they rule. The begats, wait till they rule on the yeshiva exemption. You don't go to jail. It's not democratic. A kid in North Tel Aviv goes to jail. It'd be interesting. Anyway, fascinating to read. I also want to prove to you I was absolutely right about Satmar becoming followers of our world. And my student, this is a cousin of a student, Rabbi Chaim Richman, international director of the Temple Institute, Makom HaMikdash, from flight to light, giving a lecture on Makom HaMikdash in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Details on RSVP, save the day, come and bring a friend. No address given for fear of a bomb being thrown, but it tells you how to contact. And Jay, did you get the gift I had? Okay, we're equal on that. I'll leave this for next week. I kept you overtime. I apologize. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das vidanya.
In the back of every misifta, there's a section for the Torah of Perach.
Right.
That has allegorical interpretation of the Gemara.
Show that to Alex. Sure. Show that to Alex.
Wow. That's just fantastic.
Wow. Every misifta has it.
Did you see Ramon versus Simon's baseball?
I have a picture of it.
Oh, you see it already?
Okay. I have a picture.
Okay.
So where's my baseball? One second. They don't show. I don't show my baseball. I'm alive with
kids. Yeah. Yeah.
Mine is next to his.
Who's this educator in Chicago? He has a whole collection.
When you come into his office, there's the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
It's all the famous rabbanim in the world with baseballs. And I signed mine, Aaron Rakefit, a Yankee in Jerusalem. On the other side, it's Aaron Rakefit in Hebrew. It's unbelievable. And a kid comes in, his face lights up.
I forgot to ask the Rebbe. The Rebbe has a grandson, Ackerman. He's friends with my grandson, Mordechai Gold.
So this kid can hit field, has everything. Brilliant, matmid personality. But like all my grandsons, they all want to make a living. I have not, because they know how much I suffered in the 70s. You see, you have to take the microphone out. So you know what he's doing. Kid's a genius. He's on at the age of five, he was doing math that I didn't understand. He's on a tudai, technion, what the army wants, what the army needs. So
that's funny. I have the opposite. I have my grandson, one from Moresha. He finished Machon Lev. The graduation is actually finished last year. He's in Alon Shvut, and the army is begging him to come.
Right.
And he says, no. He says, there's plenty of people do computers, this and that. How many people can be Gedolim in Torah?
I've asked my kids. I get the same answer. They want to make a living. I can't argue with it.
He has a trust fund.
But you should know, I told Gabby Cohn just the other day, I said, Gabby, I used to come Shabbos to Machon Gold once a month, and Nechama Leibovitz came, and you were so excited what we would do. I can't because I had no money for food. So Gabby said to me, he knows the problem, but he said he had one advantage. His wife was an only child. You follow? He said, my wife is an only child. He was honest, and my wife is an only child.